Graphic Audio. A movie in your mind.
Captain Serrano, Sweet Delight.
Station Tug 34, permission to grapple.
Permission to grapple.
All fast, on your signal.
Captain Serrano of Sweet Delight, permission to undock on your signal.
All clear on station. Confirm all clear aboard.
All clear aboard.
Graphic Audio presents The Serrano Legacy by Elizabeth Moon. Book 2, Sporting Chance, Part 2. Narrated by Nanette Savard. With performances by Colleen Delaney, Sonny Lasky, Lily Beacon, Terrence Azelford, Andy Van Dorn, Andy Clements, David Coyne, Thomas Penny, Ariane Parker, Ken Jackson, Michael John Casey, Elizabeth Demery, Kate Torrey, Christopher Graybill, Richard Rowan, Karen Carbone, Dylan Lynch, Jeff Baker, Peter Stray, James Konacek, and Mort Shelby.
Previously in Serrano Legacy, Book 2, Sporting Chance. After the young people survive the almost deadly incident on Cerealis, Lady Cecilia de Marktos is asked to ferry Prince Gerald back to his home planet on her yacht. But while en route, Cecilia's nephew Ronnie makes a troubling discovery.
I think something's wrong. If I didn't know it was Gerald, I wouldn't believe it was the same person.
Better not tell anyone. It's dangerous knowledge.
But I must. He's the only surviving prince.
Captain Serrano!
What's wrong? Is your aunt...
Aunt Cecilia's in a coma. They don't know if she'll come out of it. She just fell down. She's had a massive stroke.
You know what they're saying about you. Berenice is hinting that you did something to cause the stroke.
Did Ronnie tell you about the will? Apparently she changed her will almost as soon as she arrived, and she left me, a substantial legacy. The yacht. If you can visit Lady Cecilia without arousing suspicions, perhaps you can ascertain if she really is brain damaged or not.
Oh, my.
It is a very delicate matter, possibly quite dangerous. I would not consider asking you were it not for your military background, your proven courage, and your discretion.
You want me to steal the yacht out from under the noses of the family, against all law and regulation, and go to Navarne and take the prince from there to the Guerny Republic to attempt a treatment you know nothing about?
This is the craziest idea I've ever heard. You want to take a sick, paralyzed old lady up in a hot air balloon?
Brunn crouched as the burner roared and pulled the blanket she'd brought along over Cecilia's crumpled form. Finally, it always seemed to take too long, the balloon rose with a jerk and the basket hung straight beneath it. Brunn looked down at someone who had had to dive away from the basket on the terrace behind another unit.
Sorry! Bad currents!
She watched ahead. She could continue to ascend between that balloon and the other, and there was just room to use the directional thruster as well. Carefully, she set the thruster controls and pumped the burner. The idea had been to rise directly above Cecilia's unit in hopes of not triggering any alarms when her monitor transmitters went out of range, and then catch a strong wind home. But the surface breeze, twisting between the units and deflected as well by so many jostling balloons, didn't cooperate. She was already more than 30 meters from the room where Cecilia's bed had been. She needed to gain altitude and start running now. Her balloon rose, she felt the pressure in her boots. Now she could see over the last row of units. Was that Ronnie, walking toward the administration building? Someone had caught a basket in a tree. That balloon, deflating, draped itself over the tree like a discarded party dress. A vast green and silver surface blocked her view as it slid by, someone else's balloon. Out the other side, she saw a yellow striped with light blue. Above, her own balloon blocked her view. She had to hope that she didn't bump into someone from below. Now she was higher than most of the others, than anyone near. Behind and below, balloons obscured her view of the nursing home and its meadow. Most were still aflight, but some were on the ground, surrounded by clumps of people. Ahead and higher were other balloons headed for the shore, but no one was near her. That in itself was dangerous. Anyone might notice the color of a balloon that lifted too suddenly from the nursing home. She looked back again, glad to see that five or six others were rising as fast now. They would block a clear view of hers from the ground. She let go the burner controls. In the sudden silence, she checked her gauges, still rising slowly. She knelt beside the crumpled shape, and as gently as she could, tugged Cecilia to a half-sitting position. The older woman's skin was cold, but she had a strong, regular pulse, and she seemed to be breathing normally. Brunn stuffed a pillow under her head.
Oh, it's Brunn, Lady Cecilia. If you can hear me, we've got you out. Here, smell this.
She tugged out her riding gloves and laid them against Cecilia's face. A nostril fluttered.
That's it. Horse and dog and out of doors. I can't talk more. We're in the air.
She stood up again. Behind, the other balloons were gaining altitude on her. The nursing home was now a blur of dark trees and bright meadow, the units scarcely visible. With any luck, the attendants were still too busy with the chaos to be watching her. From here, at this altitude, the wind would take her straight to the picnic site on the shore. Above, the northbound current of air should be shifting as the front neared, and the southbound current above that would sweep her past the shore, on across the bay to the peninsula where her landing crew waited. She eyed the clouds to the west. The residual sense of where her body was jolted Cecilia into wakefulness. Something was wrong. Pressures in the wrong place, and then she felt herself falling and cramped into a position she could not change. She smelled of fuel gas and something that reminded her of flower baskets without the flowers. And in great gusts, the fresh green smell of spring she had been kept from. Mown grass, oak trees, the bitter tang of willow.
Outside? I'm outside?
It must be the rescue she had prayed for. Overhead, the roaring went on and on. She felt a vague nausea. She heard distant roars, distant voices, and the nearby creaking of baskets again. She felt herself being moved. Then the scent of horse and dog and leather. She wanted to cry for joy. She wished she could move a finger at least. But it was enough just to be out of that place.
There's a chance of surveillance. I can't talk to you all the time, but don't be afraid.
She wasn't afraid now. She wasn't afraid for the first time since the hospital. If the balloon, she had put together her memories of the roaring burner, the smell of gas, the sound of wicker, fell out of the sky and killed them both, she would not be afraid. Not now. She busied her mind with interpretation of the smells that rose from below through the basket. That made it easier to ignore the lurch in her stomach every time the burner roared and the balloon lifted abruptly. At some point, they flew near enough to a bakery to sail through a gust of aroma from new bread, and she tried to guess which city. She recognized the damp rot smell of the shore and wanted desperately to ask which shore, because she began to feel she almost knew where they were.
Heading southeast, out over water and into a little weather. Now that we're farther from shore, I'll put the rain cover on you.
The air smelled rich and clean, heady. She wanted to breathe in and only in forever. She would have been glad to have the rain on her face. Her skin felt starved for the moistness, the changing pressures. The landing, when it came, produced a jolt she could feel. Then the disorienting sensation of being put in all the wrong positions.
Hauled out like a sack of grain.
I certainly can't help. Then a familiar position, flat on her back on some surface, but a vibration rumbling the entire surface. The sense of a spring night still enchanted her. They must be in a vehicle with open windows. She could smell the new grass, a fruit orchard in bloom, all the good smells of open country. No one talked. All she could hear was the wind rush outside. When the vehicle stopped, she felt movement again as her surface, bed, stretcher, was lifted out and rolled somewhere. She sniffed again. This smelled mechanical, almost industrial. Metal, plastics, pavement.
A warehouse? A factory?
Another lift, and she was in a different set of smells. Almost all plastics and fine oils, like a shuttle. A shuttle. She was being shipped off planet?
If I were making this up, I would figure out some way for my heroine to communicate. It's entirely too boring to lie here, knowing nothing.
Her mind ran through the private shuttle ports and decided they were at Bunny's Crown residence. She felt the firm pressure of acceleration on her body. Wherever they were going, they were on the way. Wherever they were going, it had to be better than where she'd been. Brun laid her hand, smelling of soap, lightly pine-scented, along Cecilia's cheek.
I'm sorry I couldn't talk to you earlier. Those who helped me could not know who you were. They think you're a drunken friend of mine who's going to wake up on station as the result of a festival wager. You're wearing balloonist gear, and it's fortunate you don't look your age. You probably wonder why we took the risk of taking you off planet right away.
Cecilia hadn't yet wondered that, but now she did. Why not simply hide her somewhere until she recovered?
We expect a solid search effort. We weren't sure if they'd implanted a locator of some kind, and we wanted you out of range of detectors. And they might start checking private shuttle flights after tonight. Luckily, with the festival, there's sure to be more than one private shuttle up. And we don't know how long your recovery will take.
Cecilia caught a concern that it might not come. She wanted to signal, to convince Brun that she was alive inside, but nothing worked.
We need to get you to good medical care, someone we know is safe and not part of the plot, in a place where we won't be interrupted.
What about Ronnie? Where are we going? What happened to my yacht? And Harris? What kind of medical care? And how does Brun know the doctors are safe? And how long is it going to take to get my life back?
Cecilia didn't even know exactly how long she'd been like this. Months, at least. Or if she had a reason not to say it aloud. She'd already said enough to make any surveillance tapes dangerous.
Actually, we're still arguing about that. The specialists want you at a major medical facility, but Dad says that's too dangerous. Whoever did this is bound to be checking the best-known facilities. He wanted you back home, but your Captain Serrano said the same argument applied to that. She thinks you ought to be somewhere with horses, somewhere obscure. There's a couple of possibilities. Dad's been checking them out, and once we get to the yacht, I'll have his latest advice. But there's the medical problem.
The medical problem. Whatever had been done to her, whatever might be undone. Cecilia wanted to argue her own case, demand the risks of the top specialists, explain who might have done this and why. But that would have to wait until she could talk, if she ever could. Cecilia surprised herself by falling asleep in the shuttle. Real sleep, deep, comfortable sleep. She felt safe, with Brun's hand on her cheek, safer than she had felt in months. She had a brief panicked moment when she awoke, but the medicinal smells interwove with more pleasant ones.
Better strip the programming on those sphincters. We'll want to keep her hydrated, but we don't want any distension.
But let's check the drug port. They may have an implanted delivery system, and there might still be residuals.
Just remember that she can hear you. Talk to her, not just about her. You're on the yacht now, Cecilia. I think you went to sleep for a while, though it's hard to tell. You've got Dr. Cherda and Dr. Illick with you right now.
I'm Dr. Cherda. I'm a geriatric neurologist with special interest in pharmacological insults. I'm checking the ports on your chest, cardiac monitor, venous access, feeding tube. There's a set of three miniature pumps in the venous access. I'm gonna have to take these out very carefully.
Cecilia could just feel a faint tug. Disconcerting, but not painful.
Brune, if you'll take these over to the bench there.
Can you tell what the drugs are?
Probably. At least we can tell the class, and if it's referenced, we can identify it precisely. If not, it may take a while. What the drugs do is my specialty, but identifying them isn't. We can get it done, though. Now, I'm going to leave the rest of this in. We'll want the cardiac monitor and the venous access, although I hope we can get her... off the feeding tube and back on oral.
I've got the signals on the implants. Standards in this Model 5s, and we have the manuals. Brune says your hearing is... I know that's possible. I'm Dr. Illich. You met me at Cerealis when young Ronnie was in the hospital there. I was the tall, skinny, bald one.
Cecilia remembered a pleasant, homely face and jug ears.
We're going to give you the same kind of care that you had, except that we'll be triggering your bladder implant more often. Right now, you need that again. It's been over 12 hours.
Cecilia had long given up embarrassment. It wasn't her fault someone else had to operate her once private functions. She could tell when they changed her body position, although she wasn't sure how much. It did feel better, although she'd hardly known what the vague discomfort was.
We're not going to mess with your cranial access right now. There's a small chance they put in a lockout circuit that could hurt you if we didn't key in correctly. I want a full readout of everything else first, and we're going to try to get your cranial implant to talk to our monitors. So far it's not, but I would like to see if you can swallow. We did that ultrasound when you first came aboard, and I don't think they bothered to do an esophageal pinch.
Cecilia had no idea what an esophageal pinch was, but assumed it had something to do with whether or not she could eat. The thought of actually tasting food again thrilled her, her mouth filled with saliva. Surely she had to be able to swallow, or she'd have choked before now.
Now, what I'm going to put at your lips is a soft plastic nipple on a water bottle. When you feel it, try to suck.
She felt nothing, then a dull bump as something hit a tooth. She tried to suck, but wasn't sure she remembered how. She had not had anything in her mouth in a long time.
Serious loss of sensation. Let's see.
A cool wetness, tasting faintly of lemon, filled her mouth. Cecilia swallowed without thinking. Her tongue felt ungainly and misshapen, but she didn't choke.
Very good. That time I squeezed some out. I'd like you to do it this time.
Cecilia struggled with a recalcitrant tongue and cheek muscles that no longer worked willingly. A tiny drip rewarded her. Then a trickle.
That's too much. Look at the cardiac monitor. She's straining.
But it's something. Even a tiny weak suck. And we know she's still got that. Let's see about something else.
This time it was cold and sweet and smooth. A chilled custard, perhaps. The flavor developed in Cecilia's mouth, from the initial sweetness to a rich, fruity taste. And she was able to swallow the spoonful, savoring the feel of it all the way down her throat.
Date caramel custard with a touch of almond essence.
Oh, very good. Brune, do you happen to know what foods she liked best?
She had one of the best cooks anywhere. She liked good food, all kinds.
Not all kinds. Prostatian cuisine is ghastly, and there's no way anyone can cook abrolhos cephalopods so they don't taste like oily rubber. Surely Brune can remember my favorite spices, at least.
Great. If she can eat custards now, she'll be able to eat solids very soon. I'm glad I insisted on including a dietitian in the primary team.
Cecilia wanted to glare. Dietitians thought more of nutrition than flavor. She imagined herself with a mouthful of pureed hallow beets, unmitigated by spices.
We'll leave the feeding tube access in just in case. But the sooner she's on an oral diet, the sooner we can get her on an oral communication system.
You mean talking?
No, not at first. Her inability to talk could be all neuromuscular, loss of control of voluntary muscles of speech. Or it could also involve central language problems. I suspect the latter. But if she can swallow, that means she can control her tongue and breath, and that means she can learn to suck and blow, and that means she can use a mechanical system to signal. Yes and no, at least, and probably a lot more.
But if she can swallow, then why can't she move her jaw?
Good question. It could be a local paralysis, either from an injection into the nerve or maintained by the drugs we found in that packet. Or, in a woman her age, it could be simple arthritis of the temporomandibular joint. If they kept her jaw immobilized for long enough, muscle atrophy and arthritis together could produce what seemed to be paralysis. At any rate, until she has control of her jaw, she can't chew. We can open and close it, and we will, but that's not really chewing.
Cecilia knew exactly whom she'd bite if she had the chance. These long-winded idiots who blathered on as if she weren't there. Lorenza grimaced when the light flashed on her desk comp. Someone wanted her badly enough to override the recorded message explaining that she wasn't available. She hated being interrupted after dinner. It had better be a real emergency. She picked up an impressive-looking pile of documents before flicking the screen on. That way, whoever it was would know she had been interrupted in the midst of real work. On the screen, Berenice's distorted face looked much older, as if her rejuve were failing all at once.
She's gone! She's gone!
Who?
Cecilia! She disappeared from the home sometime today. After Ronnie's visit, in fact. He says she was certainly there when he was. The attendant who let him in remembers that.
Lorenza's mind raced. She felt cold and then excited.
Perhaps he took her out for a joyride or something. Perhaps another enemy has abducted her, raped her, killed her.
No. There was some kind of mix-up with the festival. Lots of balloonists coming down in that meadow, and some getting caught in the trees. Lots of people saw Ronnie leave, and he was alone. Besides, he's as confused as I am. I can tell. I'm his mother. Laurie, she's gone! She'll die without care! I can't bear to think of it!
Berenice, who had quarreled with Cecilia for years, still actually cared about her. Lorenza thought that was stupid, but knew better than to argue that Cecilia was better off dead, especially for her own purposes.
Who do you think? Could it be that awful yacht captain?
Oh, no. She's been gone for weeks, and she couldn't have come back in the system without being caught. It's just, I can't figure out why anyone would do this.
Well, there's always kidnapping for ransom, although in her condition most such people would expect you to abandon her. Perhaps someone, some business associate, wants to do something with her assets. If they produced an imposter and claimed she'd recovered...
I hadn't thought of that.
Berenice might be over-emotional, but she wasn't stupid. Not really.
We've had auditors checking things over to be sure that captain hadn't been embezzling. Maybe someone else was.
Or maybe that captain had an ally.
I'll tell Gustav.
Surely it would be all right. Someone had kidnapped a helpless old lady. It would be either for ransom or... The idea made more sense, the longer she thought about it, to produce an apparently recovered impostor, whose remaining lapses of memory and function could be laid to the injury. Or Cecilia herself, with an AI unit implanted so that she seemed to speak what someone else had chosen. If they had enough time, whoever had done this, they could even produce a clone Cecilia. Of course, not even a clone Cecilia would know what had been done to her, or how, or who. She was, therefore, unprepared for the second call from her medical agent.
What do you mean, trouble? It's nothing to do with us. I didn't snatch her.
Have you forgotten what I told you? She needs maintenance doses, and anyone who scans her now will find those implants. If they're removed, a high-level scan will show brain activity.
Lorenza fought the impulse to scowl at the screen. She never scowled. Scowling caused wrinkles.
You said it was irreversible.
Under the circumstances we had, yes. But not in a medical facility I can't get into or send someone to. Oh, she'll never get up and walk off. At least, I don't think so. But once someone suspects she's still cognating, they'll start looking at her old scans and know they were falsified. And then they'll figure out how, and that leads to who. I want out. I want transportation and a lump sum, enough to live on.
Wait a minute. You're running out on me? Won't that make it obvious you did it?
Not if you set it up right. Do you know what they do to medical professionals who do something like this? I'll be in therapeutic reassignment the rest of my life. No, I want out. You've got to get me out of here.
But you say she can't really recover.
Of course not. Not really. But they don't need her testimony to put me at risk, I tell you. And if they catch me, I'll tell them who it was. I've no reason to protect you if I'm going to prison. It's to your advantage to keep me safe.
I see. Well, then, it will take me a day or so.
To choose which way to eliminate this unstable and most undesirable of accomplices, to make sure it would not be traced to her, to see if it could possibly be done in person. She would miss the visits to Cecilia, the chance to savor that triumph. This one could make up for it. The transfer station at Navern had none of the luxury and elegance of Rockhouse Major. It was as large, it had to be, to handle the transfers of entire troop ships, but only in the exchange did any civilians color and brighten the drab corridors and docksides. The Better Luck had come in, with its new identity unchallenged, just another scruffy little tramp freighter and her slipshod crew. Harris eyed the material she'd been given.
Recognition's supposed to be easy. The prince has seen me, I've seen him.
But the double. You might mistake the double for the prince.
The double doesn't know me. He won't approach. It's true both of them will be there, but only one will come aboard.
Like all but the restricted stations, Navern Station had no objection to civilian traffic, in moderation, and civilians could shop at the exchange, paying higher prices. Harris was claiming a subcontract with Outworld Parcel, one of the independent companies transferring small hard copy documents and packages for individuals who preferred not to use the government mail service. The Crown had provided such documents and arranged for her to dump any business received at a nearby Outworld Parcel main depot. Harris checked in at the Outworld Parcel local office, handing the clerk the little strip of platinum-embossed plastic. The clerk glanced at her as he fed the strip into the reader.
You're new on this run, aren't you? What happened to Sal?
No idea. I don't ask questions. They shift me around wherever there's a gap.
Oh, maybe that port drive pod finally went sour and he's in refitting.
The clerk touched a keypad and a sign lighted up. Outgoing active.
How long you here for? There's only a few letters now, but if you'll be here long enough for a shuttle from below, I can guarantee at least a 50-kilo cargo.
How long's that?
Let me check our downside office.
The clerk vanished into a back room. A few minutes later, he came out.
You're in luck. They can add the downside accumulation to the next shuttle, and that's tomorrow. It'll be up here by 1800, but it won't unload until 2000 at least.
I suppose. They didn't say I'd have to wait. It was supposed to be a scoop and run.
Are you time-locked for your next destination?
No. Fine. We can wait. Let me know the mass and cubage when the shuttle lifts. You have the codes.
He would return the identification strip when she signed for the outgoing mail. The exchange was next door. Harris glanced in at rows of displayed merchandise. Once, such places had been her territory. She had paid the lower military price. She had felt at home. Now, she made herself enter, with a quick smile at the security guard by the door.
New on station?
Right. The Better Luck. We have a subcontract with Outworld Parcel.
About time. I'm expecting a package from my parents.
Sorry. I was sent on pickup. We didn't bring anything.
Damn it. It's been twice as long as government mail, and it's supposed to be quicker.
The guy at the office said maybe Sal had a drive out and had to go to refitting. We weren't told, but if that's true, another ship will be bringing that load.
Harris hoped Sal himself wouldn't show up in the next day or so.
Well, enjoy yourself. Shop your little heart out.
Harris wandered around, picking up an entertainment cube and a box of sweets, for which he paid an outrageous price. Having heard this complaint often from civilians while she was still in the fleet, she shook her head at the guard on her way out.
Damn it, the prices go up every trip. You expect us to maintain you in luxury while hard-working taxpayers go short.
The guard gave her the same bored look she had given others, and she almost giggled. When the shuttle arrived, Navern Station took on a spurious gaiety. Harris cast a critical eye on the young officers, and almost immediately thought better of Ronnie and George at their worst. The Royal Aerospace Service, known to those in the regular space service as the Royal Ass, attracted the wealthy and highborn into its officer corps. The young officers sported a foppish uniform with an abundance of braid and shiny metal, sky-blue tunics with cream facings over dark blue trousers, cream and scarlet piping on every seam, tall, shiny boots. No wonder they seemed as businesslike and military as a gaggle of debutantes. Most of them quickly shed their colorful uniforms for even more outlandish and expensive civilian clothes. Whatever sense they might have shown at their duties on planet, they shed as quickly. and Harris saw little sign of supervision or discipline. She was glad she had no responsibility for them. Navern stationers wouldn't put themselves out for a small tramp freighter, which could be assumed to have no spending power, but 50 familiar Royal Junior officers were another matter. Harris could hardly believe it was the same service area she'd seen before. Suddenly, there were dozens of attractive young men and women, far more than one per officer, she suspected, strolling the corridors, bait for even more colorful fish. A door that had presented only a blank, gray metal face before now opened on a cozy bar with a live band playing in one corner. The smell of real food wafted out another door that Harris hadn't seen. Two sleek, dripping, naked figures chased each other out a door just in front of her. That argued for the existence of a swimming pool.
But where is the prince?
He should have had a message. They had sent one in the code given them, and he was supposed to make the contact. She would have no excuse to hang about once she'd collected the Outworld parcels cargo. She needed to find him, or have him find her, now. She strolled back toward the OP office to check the status of the cargo. The clerk was harried. A line of impatient young officers had hand-carried mail and packages to check through.
Oh, another shift at least, even with no more problems. Tarash is out with something she ate, and Jivvy sprained an ankle, but the clinic is packed. It always is with this bunch.
Fine. Let me know.
Back aboard Better Luck, she checked on the progress of the cockroach egg hunt. They had cleared the bridge and the galleys and were working on the owner's quarters. If the prince found cockroaches aboard, Harris knew the news would spread. She took a look at what had been an elegant guest suite in which the prince had traveled from Cerealis. Bare decking and bulkheads, just as in crew quarters, with the bed platform's framing all too visible. Oblo had installed a bare-bones communications node, nothing like the handsome system Cecilia had had, with its touch screens and voice response. Plenty of bedding, though, and towels, and those colorful pillows. Worst, though, the suite still held a faint odor of cockroach. Harris realized she was wrinkling her nose. That would never do. She'd send someone to buy an olfactory screen. Gradually, Cecilia began to regain a sense of structure in her existence. Brunn and the other attendants spoke to her often, telling her what time it was, what watch, who was in the room, what they had done, and were about to do. She could not see the light level change or the colors they described on the walls, but she could imagine it all. She began to know, when she woke, what shift to expect, who would be in the room. So she knew it was morning. Ship's morning, early in the main day shift, when the doctors both arrived to explain her situation as they then understood it.
Lady Cecilia, I'm now sure that you're able to hear, and I hope understand what we're saying. I'm going to explain what tests we've done and what more we can do aboard the yacht and what we'll be trying to do later. You may know more about what happened to you than we do, although we're ready to make an educated guess. The drugs we found in the Venus Access reservoirs consisted of a perfectly ordinary array of cardiac drugs, which would have been dispensed automatically at signals from the cardiac monitor, and some very unusual neuroactive drugs, one of them not in the databanks at all. I suspect that these drugs were merely for maintenance, not the ones that caused the initial damage. We can't tell yet how much function will return just because you no longer have the maintenance drugs in your system, or how long it'll take. It depends on how the damage was done, and whether the maintenance drugs were considered essential or just a safeguard against spontaneous recovery. I can tell you that the maintenance drugs targeted voluntary muscle innervation, motor and sensory both. Thus, I expect you to regain some sensation of touch and some ability to move. How much is impossible to say. It is unusual for someone with your level of deficit to be able to breathe spontaneously. They did a fine job of sparing respiratory function. It's amazing that you can hear. And yet, the few medical records we were able to get indicate that you couldn't, that your auditory cortex was inactive in the presence of both speech and sound. Either someone fiddled with the scans, or I can't imagine what.
Cecilia struggled to remember the early days, what everyone had said. She knew the lawyer had been told she could not hear. She had heard that. She remembered hearing about the scans that were supposed to prove it. That suggested intentional deception. But she had no way to let Dr. Cherda know what she had heard. Over the next few days, sensation returned slowly in odd patches. One time, Cecilia woke, she felt the side of her face as if it were a patch of harsh cloth laid on her skull. She felt the slight pressure of air against it from the ventilator. The nurse's gentle face washing felt like being scrubbed with a broom. Still, she could not move, could not flinch away. Later that day, she had an uncanny sensation in her left arm, as if something were crawling down it from shoulder to elbow, and from there along the outside of her forearm to her little finger. The feeling grew to a tingle, then an itch, then a painful throbbing that subsided gradually over far too long a time. Each time Cherda came in, she touched Cecilia everywhere, explaining the process over and over. The monitors they had, crude as they were compared to those in a major neuro ward, showed Cecilia's response, and Cherda was mapping the return of sensation. The nurses and Brunn massaged her too, and gradually, fitfully, she remapped the feeling of her own body. Blank patches remained. Her left upper chest had no sensation. That was where the implant ports were. They'd probably destroyed the innervation there. That was standard practice. She felt nothing on the insides of both arms, where the median nerve should have supplied sensation and controlled movement. One foot regained sensation in a maddening pins and needles form days before the other. Her nose itched. The first movement, the first real movement, came when the nurse's washcloth dripped cold on her shoulder. She flinched and knew she moved. She tried again. The nurse ran for a doctor and returned with Dr. Cherda.
Again.
Cecilia twitched again, as proud as if she'd just taken a big drop jump.
That's excellent. Now try the other one.
Cecilia tried, but couldn't remember how to move that shoulder. Someone tickled her just above the collarbone.
Ah, yes.
She struggled again and felt her skin move against the sheet.
Not as strong, but something. Good progress. Keep doing that.
She kept doing that, but it didn't seem to lead anywhere. She tried to imagine what it looked like, the twitch of a shoulder. Not as communicative as a facial expression. And no matter how she struggled, she couldn't move her hands. Surely she would have to move her hands to use sign language. Then, 3 days later, when Cherda had pulled her lower jaw down, she snapped it closed so hard her teeth hurt. She couldn't open it, but she could close it when Cherda opened it again.
Yes, a good response. Now we start your communication training. I know you're an intelligent adult, and I know there's lots you want to say, but we'll start with what we need to know first. We want you to have a yes and a no. Right now, your shoulder jerk is your strongest motion. Let's try one jerk for yes and two for no. Understand?
Cecilia twitched her shoulder with contemptuous ease.
I could have done that 3 days ago. Why didn't they tell me? Why didn't I think of it?
Good. Now, did you like your breakfast?
Breakfast had been a bland flavor of custard. She had never liked bland anything.
Excellent. You may not realize it, but you've just demonstrated that your higher language functions are still intact. You understood both directions and a question form. Did you like lunch?
Lunch had been the date caramel almond custard, her favorite of the flavors she'd had.
Now I've got to ask you a lot of boring questions that are standard on neuropsych exams. And I'm going to record this on full video because it may be used in court to establish your competency.
Cecilia hadn't thought of that. Could someone who only twitched one shoulder be considered competent legally? She had thought she couldn't fight that battle until she was well.
Is your name Cecilia DeMarctos? Do you know where you are?
Now that was a hopeless question. Cecilia knew she was on a yacht, but she had no idea where the yacht was. She shrugged both shoulders, the right more strongly. Apparently, that got through.
Bad question. Are you in a hospital? Are you in a spacecraft? Are you aware of the nature of your disability? Was this disability the result of natural causes?
No one was going to believe this, Cecilia thought. It might convince Cherda or Bunny, but she couldn't see it working in court. Cherda proceeded to questions of reasoning and general knowledge, most of them ridiculously easy.
Is a circle a geometric solid?
No, of course not.
Is a horse a mammal?
Yes, dummy.
Did you name Harris Serrano a beneficiary in your will?
Yes.
Did Harris Serrano unduly influence you to make her a beneficiary in your will?
No!
Cecilia made those twitches as big as she could, and then a muscle in her back cramped. Cherda stopped the questions and patiently massaged the cramp out.
I wish we could give you muscle relaxants, but I don't want to risk any more dissociation between your nerves and your muscles. Things are bad enough.
Cecilia wondered what that meant. She had thought things were going well. If she could move a shoulder now, if she could answer questions. She pushed aside her own doubts and refused to pay attention to the doctors. Whatever the medical agenda, her own would include figuring out a way to ask for specific foods, things with more flavor and more texture. Now, with even that meager amount of communication, the days moved more swiftly. Would she like to try something with more texture?
Yes!
And a mouthful of something soft but grainy, still too bland, challenged her ability to move her tongue and swallow it. Would she like music?
Yes!
This music?
No.
Trial and error, more error than success at first, remapped her choices in flavors and music. As she had feared, the dietitian could not be persuaded to offer really tasty food, and there was no way to say, "More garlic, you idiot," with a twitch of the shoulder. She learned to move her knees one by one, and wished someone would think of using the twitch of her other shoulder and both knees for other useful signals, but no one did. Yet. In her mind, she fashioned her own code. More, less, not yet, hurry up, enough, go away, question. The question signal would have been really helpful. She had more to ask them, she thought, than they had to ask her. But she realized, from their talk, that they were fully engaged already in discovering what had been done to her, and what might be done about it. For the urgency they conveyed, she could forgive a lot.
Captain, two young gentlemen to see you.
This had to be the prince, and presumably some necessary companion. Valet, bodyguard, whatever. Harris made her way quickly to the access tube. The prince, all right, just the same as she'd seen on Cerealis, with that smug little smile on his face. Beside him, she blinked as she focused on the other face. The same face, rather. Side by side, two apparent princes, both with that smug little smile. Both in uniform, for a wonder. Her mind ran headlong into the logical flaw here. The prince and his double, of course. But the prince and his double were not to be seen together.
Welcome aboard, Mr. Smith, I believe.
Harris offered the same bland smile to both of them, no longer sure which was which.
Yes, Mr. Smith. Yes, Mr. Smith.
Even their voices sounded alike, which might mean vocal training or surgery there, too. Impressive, but still stupid. If they'd both come up on the shuttle with the others, then everyone on the station knew.
We don't have a lot of time for games. We'll be departing as soon as the Outworld parcel cargo comes aboard, and in the meantime, we'll need to ensure that your, double has appropriate cover.
I just came to tell you I'm not going. I don't want to spend more time on this yacht, especially since it's not even carpeted.
But your father planned...
If my father insists, let my double do it.
Sir, it's extremely important...
Besides, I am perfectly healthy. There's nothing wrong with me. My own physician checked me out after we arrived at Rockhouse.
Harris wondered if his voice was really more childish than it had been. His blue eyes were guileless as a child's, his expression mildly annoyed. Nothing quite fit.
Your father told us to take you. He really wanted you to go. He said you would...
But I don't want to.
But he'll be mad at me.
Harris had seen the trick work once with a hysterical senior minister. It didn't work this time.
So?
They both glanced around, boredom and contempt plain on their features. Harris wanted to smack their heads together.
We shouldn't discuss this here. Come along to the bridge. You never saw it before, did you? And we can settle things there.
It won't make any difference. I'm not going.
Harris refrained from comment and simply gave them the regulation smile that so often got her way. They shrugged and followed her into the ship, scuffing their boot heels on the deck. At least they didn't comment on any odd smells. Perhaps the last of the cockroach odor had adhered to the powdery scavengers in the air circulation. She stopped by her office to show the prince and his double the official authorization from the king himself.
I didn't doubt you. I quite understand that you are who you are, and my father told you to come and get me. But I'm not going.
Oh, yes, you are, you little brat.
Harris then led the way to the bridge.
Pretty.
The prince was looking at Sirkin, Harris realized after a moment. Not the bridge layout at all. Janice gave him a look, and Harris began to hope the other one was the prince. She'd forgotten the prince's temporary attraction to Raffaella. Perhaps he liked dark-haired girls best, and considered Sirkin an adequate substitute.
If you had more girls like this, I might reconsider. But it simply won't do.
Perhaps you should take a look around. Your suite is a little bare now, but we've funds to provide some amenities from the station sources. Let Mr. Janice show you around.
She gave Janice another look. He nodded. The prince and his double shrugged.
It's terribly dull on station this time. Might as well.
And they followed Janice meekly. Harris allowed herself a brief grin.
Lambs to the slaughter.
Mahari grinned, but Sirkin looked shocked.
What are you gonna do?
I wish you hadn't asked. If we take him by force, that blows the double's cover. And the king said it was important to have the double to cover for him.
Petrus had a plug in his ear, listening to the conversation with Janice somewhere else in the ship.
If we don't take him by force, he won't come. He's blathering on about the social calendar on the liner where they will have plenty of girls, he says.
I knew this was a stupid idea. His father should have known he wouldn't want to come. Unless that was the plan. The possibilities for a double cross on this mission are endless. I'm afraid we're going to have to do it, though. The only way to help Lady Cecilia is to lead the trouble away from her. And if we're believed to have kidnapped the prince, everyone in the Familias will be after us.
How can we be sure we've snatched the right one?
Standard ID scan. We've got the data from his father.
It won't work.
Of course it will. You can't fool a full ID scan with plastic surgery.
Fine, go ahead.
He smirked. So did the other prince. Harris wanted to hit both of them, but thought better of it. If she did, she'd be sure to hit the real prince, and that wouldn't do. The ID scans of both young men took only a few minutes, but the results made no sense.
Both of them are the prince. Or neither, if they're identical twins. Clones?
Clone doubles are illegal. Not that that would stop the crown.
It's ridiculous. Why didn't the king tell us?
If he knew.
Harris glared at the scan results.
He must have known. This is just like the slowness. He, of all people, cannot not know. How am I supposed to know which is which? Damn it, it's like something out of an entertainment cube, a joke or something, and it's not funny.
So, what do we do?
We take them both, and we keep them separate. We'll have to use the original guest suites, and surely there'll be something in the real prince's memories of the affair on Cerealis that will make it clear who is which.
And the, reaction?
Well, you know what they say. When you don't have any other place to step, it doesn't matter which foot lands in the shit first.
Navern Station expected ships to arrive and depart on their own power, a fortunate circumstance. With Kulkul and Petrus on the boards, the Better Luck power-up went smoothly, the displays rising through orange and yellow to the steady green of full in-system power. The FTL drive next. It was only slightly risky to power up the jump units while docked. Using them was another matter. Harris had no intention of risking another near-planet jump.
Weapons?
Code 2.
We'll go three once we're outside the near scans.
Bringing their weapons to full readiness might set off the station's own defensive armament. Too many bloody results had taught station masters to take no chances with ships in dock.
Nav?
Ready, ma'am.
Sirkin had plotted an unusual course around to the Guernsey Republic. They both hoped it would confuse any chance encounter and avoid any confrontation with ships of the Compassionate Hand.
Navern Station. The Better Luck requests permission to undock.
On the count, Better Luck.
On the count, the cables and umbilicals detached, some coiling back to the station and others to the ship. Tiny attitude controls nudged the ship back, away from the rotating station. With the power on, the ship's own artificial gravity created their internal field. They felt none of the change in acceleration so visible in the external monitors as Harris brought in the main drives and began the long curve out toward the safe jump radius. Navern shrank visibly, the Terminator creeping along its blue and white ball as they swung toward the night side. An hour passed, then another and another. Janice glanced at her, brows raised.
Station scans faded below detection. No other scans detected.
Harris had considered whether to wait until they made the first jump transition to bring the weapons up, but that had its own risk. If they were unlucky, they could come out of jump space into trouble.
Weapons to code 3.
Sir.
Janice's board had a row of scarlet dots at the top, with green columns below.
The tree's lit, Captain.
Thank you, Mr. Janice. Now if we...
Oh, shit.
No one had to ask what had happened. All the boards showed it. A ship, a large ship, armed, its weapons ready, had just dropped into the system and painted them with its scans. And there they were, their own illicit weaponry up and active, as detectable as a searchlight on a dark night.
Douse it?
Too late. We'd look even more suspicious if we blanked. We shouldn't be detecting their scans. What is it?
Their scans should be as good, and the other ship wouldn't know they had such accurate scans. She hoped.
Big. Military. Armed to the teeth. Light cruiser. If we're lucky, it's a royal ass ship full of rich playboys. Let me see.
Dumping fee like anything. They came in really hot and they don't care who knows it. That turbulence pattern's a lot like,
Corsair class. Not royals. Regs. Standard assortment up.
Which meant about half the total armament. Harris felt a pang of longing and pushed it away. She had had the bridge of a Corsair class cruiser. She knew exactly what that captain would be seeing and thinking.
Time to jump status?
Sirkin glanced at her.
Emergency? Like at Rock House?
She didn't wait for an answer. Her fingers were flying on her board, calling up the data.
Navern's a little more massive, and there's that satellite. We should use their combined center of mass for the calculation.
Harris didn't interrupt. She had her eye on the other ship's plot as the data points multiplied.
She'll have her data coming back from us. She's still on course for Navern.
The angle isn't wide enough yet. Got a beacon strip?
Just now. Fleet beacon. Now let me see. What did they say the encryption key was?
Even in the crisis, that got Harris's attention.
You got the encryption key as well as the other stuff?
Wouldn't be near as useful without it. Ah, yes. Regular space service. We knew that. Corsair class light cruiser. We knew that. The Marline Scalare. We didn't know that. And commanded by Arash Levadi. Worse luck.
Too true.
Harris stared at the scan and wished it different. The Levadi family had as long a history in the fleet as the Serranos. A Marcos Levadi had commanded through most of the campaign that established the Familius Regnant.
Arash Levadi. That means Esteban Kutsudis is Scanner One. We really are in a nest of comets.
Kutsudis was himself a legend, known for building up entire ships from the faintest data.
14 minutes 17 seconds at our present acceleration and course.
To run or not to run. With Levadi commanding, with Kutsudis on scan, the fleet vessel could not miss them and would not ignore them. The fleet vessel had a considerable excess of V. It might find maneuver difficult. Or it might not. A cruiser was by no means as clumsy as a freighter of the same mass.
11 minutes 26 seconds at maximum acceleration.
If they ran, they'd look guilty. But they looked guilty now. She could easily imagine what Arash Levadi was thinking, arriving in system to find an absurdly small freighter lighting up his scans with weapons that belonged on his own cruiser. He'd be asking Navern Station about them, and Navern Station wouldn't have any answers to satisfy him. His curly red hair would be standing up in peaks already. the incredible Kutsudis, she remembered coveting Kutsudis for her own crew, would be checking their signature against his personal memory of tens of thousands of ship signatures. Had he ever scanned Cecilia's ship? If so, he would know who they really were. Or did they already? Had they been sent here to intercept? If they ran, they might reach a safe distance for jump transition before Livadi's equally trained weapons crews could get them. Especially since he'd have to contact them first. But if they ran, he'd follow. If they didn't run, maybe they could brazen it out.
They have nothing against us.
They could answer the hail that was surely coming. They could spin out a plausible story long enough to make the jump point. Maybe. Livadi had always been one to check every detail. He would want not only code, but voice communication. Not only voice, but visual. And there it would all fall apart. Harris felt cold all over. No mere change of uniform would work with Livadi. He knew her. They had served together as junior officers on the Marino Divide. Moreover, he knew Petrus and Janice by sight. He had been aboard her ship several times, and they'd both been on the bridge. And if he had followed the courts martial, or any of his bridge crew had, he would know every face on this ship but Sirkin's. Could Sirkin play the role of captain for the time it would take? No. Harris could not ask that.
Arash Livadi knows us.
Harris advanced power, pushing the in-system drive to the limit listed for the better luck. She had another 10 grabs of acceleration in reserve, but using them would reveal that the beacon data were false. She saw on every face but Sirkin's the recognition. Then came the hail she expected, as if in response to the change in acceleration, though she knew it had originated before. She sent in reply the standard coded message.
They've stripped our beacon. Took them long enough.
I wish I knew if they'd queried the station yet.
Livadi tended to do things in order, but he had his own flashes of brilliance. If the delay in stripping their beacon meant he'd tight-beamed the station and waited for a reply, he could have known about the disappearance of the prince and his double, although Harris hoped no one had noticed yet. The shuttle to the planet wasn't supposed to leave for another 11 standard hours, and she had expected no real search for him until a few hours before boarding. She'd counted on that delay to get out of reach. But he would have the ship's identity as they'd given it to the station. He would have something to compare that beacon blurt with. Worst case, the station might even have sent visuals of the Better Luck's captain. Harris stared at the display, which attempted to simplify the complex spatial relationships of both ships and the station and the planetary mass. The cruiser decelerating relative to the planet, the Better Luck accelerating away, the interlocking rotations of planet and satellite and station. Once the scan computer had plotted the cruiser's course and decel pattern, it displayed blue. Changes would come up highlighted in orange. She hoped to see nothing but blue until they jumped, but she expected at any moment an ominous flare.
Time?
10 minutes, 4 seconds.
Blast.
Livadi was reacting as quickly as ever. And why was he here anyway? No RSS presence had been expected. Nothing the King had given her showed any planned activity near Navarin at all. Unless this was the King's double cross, it seemed entirely possible. There. The blue cone caught fire. The tip burned orange. If she were Livadi, she'd go ballistic, using the planetary satellite's mass to redevelop velocity and swing around, then push the cruiser's in-system drive to its limit to catch up with the traitor. That is, knowing what she wanted him to know, Better Luck, as built, could not possibly outrun the cruiser to the standard jump distance. Why stress his ship and waste power when the easy way would work? But what if he knew all of it? If he knew what ship this really was, and who captained her, and what she'd done leaving Rockhouse Major?
Display the remaining time to the closest computed jump distance and give me 30-second counts. I expect pursuit and warning. I prefer not to engage at this time.
She preferred not to engage at any time, certainly not with Arash Livadi's cruiser. By any sensible calculation, he could blow them away easily. The orange-tipped blue cone she saw was now leaning drunkenly to one side as the scan computer calculated new possibilities. He wasn't going to do it the easy way. He was wasting considerable power to make the course correction necessary for a direct pursuit. That suggested he knew too much already. Another hail, this one demanding voice communication.
At least he's still calling us better luck. There's a chance.
But there wasn't. The scan display showed a white star where the last fleck of orange had been. A micro jump. It lit again to show the cruiser much closer, its vector now approaching theirs. Harris admired the precision and daring of that maneuver, even as she wished his navigator had miscalculated.
9 minutes, 30 seconds.
Harris sent a voice burst. The reply expected from a ship requested to give voice communication in a directional beam aimed toward the cruiser's previous course prediction, but intersecting the new. Livati couldn't know about their new scans. He would expect that. He might pick up the reply, or he might hail again. The seconds crawled past. The displays showed their velocity increasing, the distance to a safe jump point decreasing, and the cruiser coming up behind them with a clear advantage in acceleration. Only 5 gravs, but enough to cut their margin to the jump point dangerously close. Moreover, he had more in reserve once past the kink of the course change and onto the flatter curve of their own course.
9 minutes.
If he knew, if he guessed that the ship he chased was Sweet Delight, he'd know she had more acceleration in reserve. He'd account for that. But if he thought he was overhauling a ship already at full power, he might not expect that last burst. She might be able to get into FTL before he got her. Harris weighed possibilities. His aggressive pursuit suggested he knew. His use of their faked identity suggested he didn't.
His communications to the station should be blurring out. Screens are up, half power, and his own turbulence is in the way.
He got something. Something he didn't like.
Yeah, but they're not shooting at us.
There might be another reason for that. If they've missed the prints on station, and if they told Livati, he won't blow us away, but he'll be on our track forever.
So the good news would be a shot across the bow?
Sirkin gave a sudden twitch, as if she'd only now realized what was going on.
In a way. Thing is, if he knows who I am, then he knows how I would have reacted.
Would have?
I've changed. So have we all.
The veterans settled. Without a word spoken, Harris knew she had reassured them about something no one could articulate. Sirkin glanced at the display.
8 minutes, 30 seconds.
Another request for voice communications, as if he had not received the first. He might not have, if his shields distorted the angled beam. Harris checked. If she had the standard civilian quality scans, would she have had time to notice the new position? Yes. She sent the same packaged burst. It didn't sound much like her, she thought, though a comparison to her own voice print would show that it was. At the least, the accent suggested someone with years of spacer experience, commercial or military. Harris wondered how long it would take him to react to this. Several seconds to arrive, several seconds to decompress and play. She had made the message longer than strictly necessary. A few seconds for the return. Any additional time off the clock was his reaction time.
His optical weapons are just within range. They still have active scans on us, and theirs are hot, but I'm not detecting the targeting bursts I'd expect.
Would he wait until he could deliver more firepower, or would he act now? It was harder to deliver a warning shot from behind, but easier to blow someone away. Was he wondering which to do? He would need to be much closer to deliver a warning in front of them. He had to be sure it went off far enough in front. The seconds ran on.
8 minutes.
This time, it was a voice burst hail. Oblo had it running almost as Harris saw the communications board flicker.
FRCS, better luck. This is the Familius Regular Space Service Frigate Skyfarer. You are suspected of carrying contraband. Heave to for inspection.
An old term, and not what they would do if they were going to comply. And frigate? Named the Skyfarer? Harris stared across the bridge at Oblo, who shook his head.
No, sir, ma'am. That's no frigate. But look at the old scan.
On the original scan board, which they'd left in because it was the standard required, the RSS ship's profile did indeed resemble a frigate, half the mass of a cruiser. That made no sense. Why would a captain misrepresent his ship that way? Did he expect her to willingly engage a frigate? Surely, in attempting to stop a civilian vessel, it was better to claim all the ship size you had. She'd always done so.
Our weapons profile should look to him about even, if he were a frigate. If we engaged, then he'd be legally in his rights
to blow us away. I do remember that much. But if that's his game, he can't know the prince is aboard. Or can he?
If the king, or anyone else, wanted to get rid of the inconveniently stupid prince, this would be a way. A tragedy, of course, but one to be blamed on the unstable Captain Serrano. And perhaps on her employer, or the employer's family.
You're gonna tell him?
Of course not. We're not supposed to have tight beam capability. It would be telling him and everyone else in this system.
On the tight beam, Lavati's familiar face had an earnest expression that sat oddly with the rumpled red curls she remembered. Behind his head was the curved wall of the communications booth, which meant he hoped his crew wasn't spiking into this conversation. His stubby hands raked his hair again, so that one lock stuck straight up.
Captain Serrano, it is imperative that we keep this as short as possible. You have, the wrong person aboard your ship.
4 minutes.
I know you can make jump inside the usual radius. You did it before. But don't do it now, please.
Fleet captains rarely said please to civilian captains they had already ordered to heave to.
I don't want to have to fire on you, but under the circumstances, it would be necessary. I say again, you have the wrong person aboard. You must not complete your mission.
Great.
He knew about the mission and the prince, which meant he'd been sent here to intercept her. So much for the honor of kings, Harris thought, and wondered if he knew the actual radius at which she would risk jump. They had the data from her earlier jump, but would that give them the same figures Sirkin was using? And she had no tight beam for response. Anything she sent would be available to other listeners in time.
All persons aboard this ship have His Majesty's permission to be here.
Captain Serrano, Harris, you know me.
Livati was sweating. And since he could be a cold-hearted bastard when he wanted to, he had not been sweating when they'd stood before old Admiral Connaught to answer his questions about the alleged massacre of civilians on Chisholm Station. Something about this bothered him.
You have the wrong, individual. It's not Mr. Smith, but a,
I have two individuals. Both carry legal identification which matches their descriptions. Neither is a fugitive.
Captive, yes, but not fugitives. And, of course, they both fit the description of the same person, but that was another problem, not his.
You have two clones. I have the real prince, and we need to get him aboard your ship. Without anyone noticing, although the way you've been behaving, anyone would.
Captain Lavati.
Had she ever called him Arash? Had she ever really run her fingers through those rumpled red curls and felt a thrill? If so, it was the thrill of being noticed by someone slightly senior. The thrill of ambition realized, not the thrill of passion. She could remember that bit well enough.
We received departure clearance from Navarin Station. Our course since then has been in accordance with the filed plan. We took on only a single bin of cargo, the outworld parcel shipment, for which we hold a legitimate subcontract. All personnel aboard have been identified by legal methods, and none is a fugitive from justice.
More than that, she could not say. Would not say.
3 minutes.
We cannot let you continue with clones in place of the prince. It would embarrass the crown.
It would more than embarrass the crown. The illegality of using unmarked clones as royal doubles would throw a political bombshell. Harris could not begin to imagine what would be destroyed.
They're in easy range now. Not just the OR weaponry, but the overboosted missiles, too. Either boost us out of here or we're dinner on the table.
Harris, you have to trust me. I know it's hard. I know about the problem you had, but you have to ignore that. You know I wasn't part of that.
But do I?
We have to talk, face to face. Or I'm sorry, but...
Meet you at the tank.
Harris wondered whether he would remember and understand that reference. It was worth a try. To her relief, his face relaxed.
Deep or shallow?
The orange bucket.
2 minutes, 30 seconds.
Livati's face constricted in a mass of wrinkles as he seemed to pry the memory out of some corner of his brain.
Your honor, Harris?
Absolutely.
With the word, she called in the last acceleration in reserve, and the Better Luck, a.k.a. Sweet Delight, skipped forward, momentarily outranging the cruiser. Livati's tight beam lost its lock, and before he could reestablish contact, They had reached the jump threshold. Harris held her hand up, waiting precious seconds until the beam found them, only then chopping a signal to Sirkin. The ship flipped into FTL space.
Whew, you got that close.
Should I give them more accurate data? He'll assume I jumped as soon as I could. Why else accelerate like that? And that's our safe margin now, what I just made for us.
But how did you know he'd try to talk again and not shoot?
It was worth a try. If we have the prince, I doubt he'd fire on us without fire from us. If we don't, if the prince is somewhere else, that's another set of problems. Suppose Levadi has the prince aboard. He must look out for his welfare. He will not invite attack. He was in our range by the time we broke the link. If he doesn't have the prince, there's still the clones. I would imagine he'd like to bring them back where they came from.
What's that business about meeting at a tank?
Well, it's true in a way. I did promise to meet him, and I do feel bound by that promise, but it should work out all right.
Care to explain?
Don't look down your nose at me. You know perfectly well it's officer's slang. You're about to find out what it means.
Harris put the reference quads up on the secondary screen.
In every sector, there's a mapped set of coordinates called the tank. If one wants to meet somewhere discreet for any reason, that's where one goes.
And every fleet officer knows it, so it's about as secret as how many royals it takes to screw in a light bulb?
Not quite that bad. Not just one set of coordinates, actually, but one for each combination of officers. It starts in training. Each class has its own definition. If you become friends with someone, you may choose to share your definition of tank. For one sector, or several, or all. In fact, it's always shifting, because we use it even within a single ship or on a station. Lazy people might give the same set to everyone, but neither Levadi nor I were lazy. Not that way. Orange bucket to him means a particular set of coordinates.
Harris highlighted them.
In this sector. And not a difficult jump away, nor out of the way to where we want to go.
Weapons?
Oh, live, of course. Just in case he's got someone with him, or we hit bad luck again. Sirkin, what's our onboard time going to look like to reach those coordinates?
30 hours, give or take. What insert velocity?
I'd like to come in slow, minimal turbulence. We'll be on a similar vector unless he double jumps, which will give us even more time. Work out the details.
Harris pushed herself to her feet.
And now, if you'll join me, Petrus, we'll have a word with our passengers.